This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Facebook and $50 billion. That's a nice symmetry to it, don't you think? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. You can look me up on Facebook this Monday, the 3rd of January, and that is where we're going to start today, not with my Facebook account, but with the news that the social networking site could be worth as much as $50 billion. A $450 million chunk from Goldman Sachs and another $50 million from a Russian firm, news of which broke over the weekend, is how we get to that eye-popping total. Goldman is also said to be lining up wealthy investors of its own to plow more money into a company that doesn't even have a ticker symbol yet. Facebook is, of course, still privately held and may stay that way for some time to come. For more on the story, we've got Marketplace's Steve Henn on the line. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Guy.
So Facebook, I mean, does it even need to go public if it can raise so much money all by itself?
You know, it's hard to see what the upside of an IPO for Facebook would be at this point. I mean, obviously right now they can raise as much money as they possibly need from places like Goldman and international private equity funds. And they gain some advantages from remaining a private company. They can lure talent away from companies like Google by offering pre-IPO shares. You know, they're avoiding reporting requirements, which is also a big plus. And, you know, often for IPO firms, the real pressure to go public is that their founders and the early employees want that payday. You know, they want to buy a house in the hills or a sports car. But, you know, that's not really the case here because those employees and those founders can sell their shares already on private markets.
Right. So these are the secondary markets, not controlled by the SEC or anybody.
Yeah, that's right.
What does Goldman Sachs get for its $450 million other than, it must be said, a chunk in a booming company?
Well, it gets two really great things for the firm. The first is it clearly gets the inside track on taking Facebook public if and when that day comes. And that would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars in fees. Second, it also gets the chance to sell pieces of Facebook to its clients, those wealthy individuals and institutions whose money Goldman manages. And that's, you know, invaluable, right? If my broker is Goldman and your broker is Morgan Stanley and I can buy Facebook and you can't, you're going to be jealous.
What about the Securities and Exchange Commission, though? If Facebook has all these extra shareholders courtesy of its Goldman brokerage, doesn't it then have to report more information about itself anyway?
Well, you'd think so, right? There's a rule that a private company can't have more than 500 shareholders without filing public disclosures. But not surprisingly, Goldman thinks it's found a way around that. They're going to create a special purpose vehicle, and legally, that will be the owner of all of their shares. And people will be buying into that company. They won't be buying Facebook directly. And so through the special purpose vehicle, they'll be able to get around that SEC rule. And there's another wrinkle here, too. So remember, we were talking about secondary markets before. One of the biggest buyers of Facebook shares on those secondary markets was the other company in the deal today. It's this Russian firm called Digital Sky Technologies. And they basically have been aggressively buying shares on these markets in three companies, Facebook, Zynga, and Groupon. And that gives all of those early employees cash. You know, they can go out and buy their sports cars, and it removes the pressure to go public, and it doesn't really increase the number of shareholders, right? So if you have 20 employees who want to sell and one buyer in Digital Sky Technologies who wants to buy, you're actually reducing the number of shareholders you have. And they work really closely with the management of these firms to make that work.
Marketplace's Steve Henn on the latest on the Facebook IPO rumors. He is, by the way, my Facebook friend, Steve Henn is. Steve, thanks a lot.
Take care.
That Russian company Steve was talking about owns about 10% of Facebook. We've got a list of the company's other high-profile investors on our website. It's marketplace.org. Over on other actually publicly traded markets today, mostly good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to skip the semi-obligatory Congress is coming back into session this week story today in favor of something else right now. Sometime this spring, lawmakers are going to have to vote on whether to raise the debt limit, literally how much money the government's allowed to borrow. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more now on a deadline that may seem far off but is already shaping the economic debate.
Republicans are using the debate over the debt ceiling as a bargaining chip. Some say they won't vote to raise it unless some federal spending is cut. There's been a lot of speculation in Washington about where the Republicans' axe might fall. Economist Robert Shapiro was an undersecretary of commerce in the Clinton administration.
They will demand changes in the health care reform and try to claim budget gains from that.
For example, by pushing to eliminate the mandate that everyone buy health insurance, then the government wouldn't have to subsidize insurance for people who can't afford it. Other Republicans say restricting Social Security payments is their price for a yes vote on the debt ceiling, limiting Social Security benefits for wealthy seniors, or raising the retirement age. Veronique Desrougis is an economist at George Mason University.
Some reform in entitlement will happen. I think lawmakers are building up the courage to talk about reforming Social Security.
But will the budget hawks really vote against raising the debt limit if their demands aren't met? If the government hit the debt ceiling and couldn't borrow, the U.S. would default on its debt, forcing a government shutdown and hurting the global economy. Given that, Brookings political analyst Stephen Hess says,
a lot of this is trash talk. The idea that anyone is really prepared to put the U.S. government in bankruptcy is ludicrous.
Hess says the best we can hope for is the trash talk will set the scene for serious budget discussions in the future. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
So let's see where that story left us. The deficit is a whopper. Jobless rates are still high. So far, 2011 sounds a whole lot like 2010 economy-wise. Shoppers are still shopping, but a lot of people have traded down to discount stores. That bodes well for the likes of Dollar General. Today, that company announced a major expansion, hundreds of new stores, thousands of new jobs, and perhaps a sign that companies are becoming more confident. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Dollar General plans to open 625 new stores this year, a move it says will create 6,000 jobs. The retailer is like a mini Walmart. It carries food, health and beauty products, basic apparel, all at discounted prices. And during the downturn, the name alone, Dollar General, was enough to attract newcomers.
Hey, it's on the way home and I'm getting a good deal and I'm being a little bit more pinched with my pocketbook these days.
That's retail strategist Jack Horst with Kurt Salmon. He says once the new clientele got inside of Dollar General, they had an epiphany.
Wow, that was different than I thought. I found a wider assortment of products, a nice shopping experience. I know Dollar General has spent a great deal of money on updating and upgrading the store experience.
The expansion may be a sign that the upgrade was worth it. It could also mean companies are ready to unleash cash they've been hoarding for several years. Standard & Poor's analyst Howard Silverblatt says S&P 500 companies have a record amount of cash on their balance sheets, $902 billion as of last September. He says Dollar General's cash outlay may give it a jump on its competitors.
It's an opportunity for them in this market. The trick for them is to expand into that market without hurting their margins and keeping their customers when times get better.
And keeping those customers from going to Walmart. The big box discounter has begun experimenting with smaller neighborhood stores like Dollar General's. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Wikipedia has hit a big financial milestone. It raised $16 million in just 6 weeks. That's its entire fundraising goal for the fiscal year, twice what it raised last year. came in small donations, mostly $20 or so apiece, from hundreds of thousands of Wikipedia users all over the world. And Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports the success just might have something to do with the face of Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales.
My teenage son lives on Wikipedia, researching vampires and werewolves, and at the top of every search lately, there's been Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales, not a werewolf exactly, but with piercing eyes and definitely in need of a shave.
Putting Jimmy Wales' face up there was incredibly effective because it then became donate to get rid of his face.
Philanthropy expert Lucy Bernholtz says there was even a Twitter campaign to donate now and spare us more face time with Jimmy. Other faces from Wikipedia also appeared in the ads. The site found that real people were more likely to inspire charity. A volunteer editor from the Indonesian language site, for instance, explained why the world needs this free online encyclopedia, which, unlike Google and Facebook, has no advertising, says Caroline McCarthy at CNET.
It's a cause that a lot of people believe in, and by keeping it a nonprofit, the company has gained a lot of followers who are big believers in free information and spreading knowledge.
And in that vein, Kai, here's a shout-out for your face. You know what to ask him for. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Face made for radio, Mitchell. That's what they tell me. Book selling just ain't what it used to be. Not only are there e-books, but online bookstores still selling actual books have completely changed things. Online retailers have been giving college bookstores a run for their money for years now. Sites like Amazon and Half.com offer cheaper textbooks that ship in just a day or two. Spending per student at college bookstores is down, so a lot of those stores are fighting back by branching out. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
At the University of California, San Diego, students can still buy a Psych 101 book, but they can also get their laptops fixed, buy surfware for the beach, print out a research paper, or shop for groceries. Store director Don Moon has been leading the effort to make the bookstore an all-purpose store, starting with a new greengrocer.
Most of the items they want are eat it now, like the sandwiches.
And fruit salads and things.
Yes, cut up, ready to go. We also sponsor Farmer's Market every Tuesday.
A bookstore with a farmer's market. That may seem like something you'll only find in California. But campus stores across the country have been beefing up their offerings to fend off online competitors. Many schools are facing limited enrollment and limited sales in the economic downturn. Don Moon has taken a page from the Barnes & Noble playbook and added a coffee shop with a lounge and performance space.
Laura, non-fat mocha?
A lot of students come in just to study because it's warm, it's comfortable, they like the environment. Hopefully while they're studying, they'll buy a candy bar and a coffee at the same time.
Charlie Schmidt of the National Association of College Stores says selling candy bars and coffee can be more profitable than Psych 101 books. On a $100 textbook, stores only earn about $6.50.
The margins are much better on the hoodies and the sweatshirts and the shot glasses.
Schmidt says stores are selling computers and other gadgets. Some have even added dry cleaning services.
It's something that the students will say, wow, I didn't know I could come to the college bookstore for that. In fact, we don't even want to say the word book in the name of the college store anymore. It's the college store or the campus store.
He says as long as the stores remain campus owned, their profits pay for school programs, scholarships, and student services. That money has become even more important at a time when states face huge deficits, states like California. Todd Summer is the director of stores at San Diego State University.
We're in the main SDSU bookstore.
Right now, we are looking at a giant iPhone.
A giant iPhone, yeah.
Summer says San Diego State is the first school with an AT&T presence in the store, the first school store with a MAC cosmetics counter. And the store's gotten a $1 million grant from the Department of Education to rent textbooks to students. Students like Hector Lopez.
I didn't have the money to buy it. So it made it easier for me just renting it out.
How much cheaper was it?
It could have been like another 60 or 70.
Lopez pays for school with scholarships and a part-time job. So $60 or $70 is a lot.
It is. I mean, because that's pretty much another book that I could be buying.
Or maybe a monthly phone plan. Or maybe a fancy calculator, or maybe a year's worth of study snacks. It's all at the store.
Okay, here's your receipt for returning your book. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, shipping by sea from Middle America? Who knew?
I had heard faintly of people shipping out of Cleveland, but, you know, I never thought about it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Best day of the year so far on Wall Street, everybody. The Dow Industrials picked up 93 points, 0.8%, closed at 11,670. NASDAQ added 38 points, right around 1.5%, 2691 at the bell. The S&P 500 tacked on 14 points, 1.1%, finished at 1271. Investors friended Goldman Sachs after the investment bank's half-billion-dollar bet on Facebook. Shares networked their way nearly 3% higher. Goldman's move boosted other financial companies that have also invested in hot tech companies recently. Shares of Groupon benefactor Morgan Stanley traded higher 3.75%. Amazon bounced up 2.33% today. It recently invested in Groupon competitor Living Social. Good day for petroleum companies today. ExxonMobil gushed up nearly 2%. Chevron spurted 0.75% higher today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.34%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Comer Science and Education Foundation, dedicated to supporting innovative programs making a positive impact on the lives of individuals and communities. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for November. How many folks drove off the lot in a new car before the end of the year? U.S. automakers are due to report sales figures for December. And on January 4th, 2007, Nancy Pelosi was elected the first female Speaker of the House. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Congress still does have a couple of more days off before the first session of the 112th Congress on Wednesday. Republicans, as you know, will be in control of the House. They've made it clear they want a do-over on the health care law, if not an outright repeal. So are we going to be spending 2011 redebating health care policy? This week, we're going to hear from some people about what the future might look like, a series we're calling What Now? Up first, commentator and New York Times economics columnist David Leonhardt on healthcare costs.
The past decade hasn't been a very good one for most people's paychecks. Is there any hope that the situation will improve in 2011? Here's one thing that would make a big difference and doesn't get much attention: the amount of money that employers spend on health insurance. And there are actually a few reasons for optimism. Let's start with some basics. Every company has one big pool of money that it can spend on compensation. The company doesn't care whether that money goes toward salaries or toward benefits. Either way, it comes out of the bottom line. So the more money that is spent on health benefits, the less that's available for salaries. We don't have to look back very far to find a time when medical costs were kept in check and salaries were rising. For much of the 1990s, insurers were making a serious effort to hold down medical costs. So spending on health benefits rose slower than inflation. Not coincidentally, the 90s were also the last time that workers received nice raises. Yes, there was an economic boom at the time, but the slowdown in health costs mattered much more than is often understood. Look around today, and you'll find a few hopeful signs that we're on the verge of another campaign to rein in health costs. Some employers and insurers, including Aetna, are experimenting with policies that do not cover the full costs of certain expensive treatments. Why does that matter? Some of those treatments have not been shown to be any more effective than much cheaper ones. Brand-name drugs, for example, are often no better than generics. The big question, of course, is how health reform will affect costs. It's impossible to know, but many economists predict that the law will reduce cost growth. Now, no one thinks that slowing the growth of health costs will be easy. Any changes will inevitably raise concerns that the quality of care could suffer. But when you consider how much more money the United States spends on health care than any other country, there is every reason to think that we're wasting a lot of money. That money isn't making us any healthier, and a lot of families sure would like to see it fattening their paychecks instead.
David Leonhardt writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. Tomorrow, Bethany McLean on the future of financial regulation. Send us your take on pretty much anything you hear on the broadcast. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. We told you earlier about the federal deficit, but proportionally, the balance sheet for a lot of states around the country looks even worse. Legislators in Illinois face a particular challenge. They're scrambling to plug a $13 billion gap, a hole that is half the size of that state's entire budget. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
State lawmakers are rushing to fix a budget problem that they couldn't fix last year. Lawrence Massal is president of the Civic Federation, which researches Illinois state and local government budgets.
The General Assembly adjourned last year without funding the pension contribution for the year, which is about $4 billion. And so that's putting enormous pressure on our pension funds as well as on the state operating budget.
If the state doesn't fund its pension obligations, those funds are expected to start running out of money in the next 5 to 10 years. And it can't all be blamed on the recession.
We've just been underfunding the pensions in order to pay our operating expenses.
That's David Merriman, Associate Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois.
We should understand that this is a political rather than an economic problem. This has been a long-term refusal of the politicians to look the fiscal facts in the face.
Credit rating agencies have already given Illinois bonds junk status. That makes it more expensive for the state to borrow. But Merriman says a political solution looks unlikely.
We'd have to do essentially every tax increase that's on the table and major spending cuts. And that would be incredibly politically unpopular.
It might be politically unpopular now, but when the newly elected officials are sworn in next week, observers say a compromise is even less likely. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Here's an underreported bit of good economic news. We learned this morning American manufacturing has now been expanding for 17 straight months. The Institute for Supply Management, the group that keeps track of that sort of thing, says the creation of new stuff, from cars to computers, is picking up speed. Part of that is because our economy is rebounding, but there is also growing demand from China and some other emerging markets. So if you're an exporter in the middle of America, you've got choices when it comes to shipping your products out. You could load things onto a plane, which is expensive. You could truck them to a port on the East Coast, which is slower, or ship them straight out through the Great Lakes. From the public media project Changing Gears, Dan Bobkoff has the story.
It is not easy to get steel mill equipment from Ohio to Germany.
This is the truck.
Especially when it's the largest piece of machinery a company has ever made.
This is a 19-axle truck, and this has a...
Earlier this year, a manufacturer near Youngstown called Butech Bliss beat out foreign firms to supply a German mill with enormous steel cutters.
Actually, the shear itself ended up weighing about 1.5 million pounds.
That's Chuck Jackson, the vice president. It was a $15 million order, half the company's annual revenue. That was the good news. The bad news? Pennsylvania and Maryland wouldn't let them truck it on their highways to the port in Baltimore. The trucks were simply too big. He racked his brain for a solution.
I had heard faintly of people shipping out of Cleveland, but, you know, I never thought about it.
That ended up being his answer. He shipped the machinery out the St. Lawrence Seaway to Germany. But this is still not that common. In recent years, an average of 2 million tons of U.S. goods has been shipped overseas through the St. Lawrence, which connects the Great Lakes to the Atlantic Ocean. But most Midwest exports are still transported over land to coastal ports.
It's essentially a chicken and egg issue.
Brad Hull is a professor at John Carroll University. He says freighter operators are reluctant to offer regular shipping service until they see more demand from exporters, but exporters want to see consistent service, and neither side wants to take the risk of going first.
So essentially you've got both sides that need to meet in the middle.
With no regularly scheduled service, much of the Great Lakes shipping that goes on now is based on need or luck. This year, a drought in Russia has boosted the grain exports from Minnesota, for instance. Will Friedman heads the Port of Cleveland.
We're not in control of our own destiny. Sometimes good things happen, but it's not because we did anything.
Friedman hopes we'll soon see the first steps to changing that. There's serious talk of starting regular container shipping from Cleveland. Feeder ships would travel to Montreal and unload the containers onto bigger freighters. For now, most Great Lakes ships, like this one in Cleveland, just have their cargo secured to the deck. Longshoremen are unloading Swedish steel plates and coils. Those are a lot harder to stack than standardized containers that can hold anything from engines to soybeans to booze. Ports like Cleveland's could never compete with the coast, but Freeman says there still could be a lot more business.
We just want to be who we are better than we have been previously.
Cleveland and Detroit's ports generate upwards of $2 billion in economic impact a year, but that's less than half a port like Baltimore. John Baker says more activity on the lakes can't come soon enough. He's with the International Longshoremen's Association and has spent decades trying to get more foreign business so his members can get more work.
It's not enough. It's never going to be enough until we see it. I keep saying it's going to happen. It's going to happen. But I don't see it. And I don't see anybody else pushing as hard as we are.
Baker thinks the ports need to do a better job marketing. They need to tell potential customers that cold weather and ice is only a problem for 2 or 3 months and that it can be easier and cheaper to get to parts of Europe through the seaway than from coastal ports like New York and Baltimore. That's what Chuck Jackson says Butech Bliss learned getting its steel cutters to Germany.
We worried and worried and worried about being late. So everything went our way, and we actually ended up over there 2 weeks early.
That's like a great advertisement for Cleveland's port, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a word on commodities as we leave 2010 in the rearview mirror. From blogger and occasional commentator on this program, Paul Kodrowski, some performance figures for selected commodities in the past year. Oil, not bad, up 14%. Orange juice, up 29%. Natural gas was the big loser, down 20%. The big winner was palladium, up 95%. What, you ask, is palladium? It's one of those rare earth metals we've been telling you about, the kind that China's not exporting much anymore. And with that, we're done. That's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow picked up 93 points, almost 1%, closed at 11,670. The NASDAQ up 38 points, right around 1.5%, 2691 at the bell. The S&P 500 tacked on 14 points, about 1.1%, 1271 there. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, oh man, I hate this.
Policyholders, or if you are interested in becoming a policyholder, press 1.
Account managers, press 2.
Or do what I do, press 0 to get to an agent, right? How companies are trying to get us to stop doing that. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.